BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio. Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show has come to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to our listeners in Bristol, Preston and also in South America. Tonight we have an interview with Katie Austin, who's currently studying at Bristol Uni. Tony has a feature on Concord designers and Antia has an interview with Kath Mail, who works with people in Gambia showing them how to make rag rugs. Malcolm Grieve reads another instalment of An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, set in Oxfordshire in the 1920s. And Jeff Sparks is here as ever with his What's On guide, and we have a poem read by Trevor Carter. I'm John Peters Coleman, and I have a very sexy voice this week because I have a cold and a sore throat. Enjoy. In the studio with me now is Katie Austin. Hello.
Hello.
So you're studying. What are you studying?
Yeah, first of all, pleased to be here. Slight surprise, but I like surprises. I actually study English, which, before you ask, it's not English literature as such. It's kind of the history of, English language. Yeah, the development of English, and I guess it is English literature, but for some reason they refuse to call it that.
Okay, so what, are you in your first year?
No, I just finished my second year, so finals next year.
Okay, right, so it's all stepping up.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Okay, intimidated?
So, I would like to say no. I'm kidding myself and saying no, but yes, very much so.
Right, okay. So what did you, how was your freshers week, and what did you have an offer to get involved with? Because that's kind of the theme of our interview, sort of various projects and extracurricular stuff you can get involved with.
Yeah, well, Bristol Uni, I guess like most unis, but obviously I don't know, we're really lucky that we have everything from kind of Brazilian capoeira dancing to a chamber orchestra that you can get involved with, and like everything at the gym as well as normal. But Fresh is the biggest event of the year. You've never been given so many free pens, free sweets, on condition for signing your life away to various societies,
right.
As you would imagine. And yeah, it's a big, they call it Freshers' Fair, and where all the societies just take over the union. I don't know how many there are, but it must run near 100 or over that. I don't really know. And it's everything, you know, even the police are there with a stall. But one of the things they do, which ironically isn't technically a society, it's called a media product, is the student media at Bristol, which is has won awards in previous years. I think for the radio and the Epigram newspaper did win awards a couple of years ago. And there's, you know, we have a radio station, and the student newspaper is really popular, actually.
Okay.
Because it's got a few different sections and they call it tabloid. For some reason, it's not like The Sun, but that's simply because it's got, I don't know, it's got a lot of content. And it's, you know, a bit like Times 2. You have the middle bit, which is what
The Times newspaper little supplement in the middle, yeah.
Yeah, where most people secretly just whip it out, do the crosswords even, and that's it. But we have one of those as well called The Mix, which is kind of fashion and more entertaining stuff.
So do you do any media that is available for sort of outside the university, or is it sort of fairly students for students?
Well, it's tricky on that, because I guess the main purpose is to get students experience of making the media and experience of doing it. So it's bad though it is, their main priority isn't really to be involved in the community. But if we had more money, if we had any spare money for the newspaper, we would happily distribute it to everybody. But at the moment, it's just student libraries, really, and the union. But the Helicon, which is a creative arts magazine, that is available in local coffee shops.
Okay.
So look out for it in mainly central Bristol, I think, but a few Gloucester Road. It's called the Helicon, like I say. But the things that everyone can access are the online products, which I think if you go to the Student Union, the Bristol University Student Union page, you can look up the TV and the radio. The radio is really well established, and that's called Burst.
Right, Burst. Okay.
Really simple name. You get so many fun names with Bristol because UB, you have so many for some reason. Tubbs, the University of Bristol, Bobshot Society, Bums, Music Society, God knows there's loads. But Burst does everything from their equivalent of the Archers, which is called the Arches.
Right.
Very original. They do everything from that to a kind of, you know, like the BBC The One Show?
Yeah.
Something a bit like that, a radio show of stuff that's interesting and stuff that's on.
Okay, so what do you do in the student newspaper?
Well, from October, I'm deputy arts editor because my main thing, if you like, is the arts, kind of watching, listening and writing. So that's my big love.
So have you been along to the Banks exhibition?
Yeah, I certainly have.
Yeah, will a review of this be forthcoming?
Oh, it's on I have a blog, actually. It's on that. But I don't think so because, like I said, it doesn't come out till October and we're trying to make it really current. Okay. And I'm afraid Banksy will no longer be current.
No, he won't. He'll be very much passé by then.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
The world will have moved on. But what did you make of it as a sort of deputy, as you're going to become a deputy arts editor? What was your sort of opinion on the Banksy exhibition? What did you think?
Well, I'm getting sick of seeing Banksy merchandise in every single shop, for one. But I did think it was really clever, and I think there is a lot more to Banksy than people might think. I know that's a bit of a cliche, but he's not just a graffiti artist, and everything he does is... It's satire, really. It's more than satire. It's not... I saw the Royal West of England Academy did an exhibition of what they call post-graffiti, which was basically... I mean, one of the pieces was just a big capitalised thing saying, "I hate the world." And I kind of thought, well, I'm sure there's some kind of point to this, but Banksy is actually commenting on society. And I'm sure most people don't get a lot of his jokes because he's very subtle and... I don't know what kind of organisation there is behind him, but I'm blowed if one individual can do all of that by themselves so quickly.
This has been said to be by a few people. They think either...
Too much.
You know, Banksy just sort of commissions... He's got this idea and he just commissions various people, or there is just more than one Banksy, sort of.
No, I think you can see a big enough fluency to see that it all comes from him. I wouldn't doubt that at all. But he's got to have some pretty big warehouse somewhere. I mean, two of my aunts came with me to see it. And they both went to art school and they were like, actually, the amount of equipment and the amount of space you need to make this volume of work and the training you need to be able to do all this, you do need some kind of support. I don't know, we can all speculate. I don't know.
Supposed to be an art student called Robin Gunningham, an ex-art student, Robin Gunningham. And somebody who used to be a flatmate with him sort of didn't deny it and said, well, it wouldn't surprise me, or words to that effect. So I don't know. And Bristol Evening Post did print a picture of a guy that was supposed to be him.
But the thing is, I think it's a bit silly to try and speculate because we're really missing the point of what Banksy is. Like, yeah, he's an enigma, but he's not really... His point is to make you think about what you take for granted or what you think is right. And I think if we go around concentrating on who he is, then we kind of miss the point of what he's doing. So until it becomes really important to know, I mean, if he actually vandalises something really badly, then I think he's public enough that if you want to get a message to him, it's not that difficult.
Right, okay.
But that's my personal opinion.
Okay. Well, a lot of people, I have met a few people who've commented on the Bristol University Union. It seems to be quite well known and quite famous, especially certainly the Union Building is quite well known. What is the state of the Union these days?
Oh, well, state in which way? I think it's the 7th ugliest building in the country or something. So I think that's one of the reasons that, I'll be honest, it has been struggling to find enthusiasm with students for going there for pretty much anything. Again, I'm sure they'd be very honest, they were in a bit of financial trouble. And like everybody in the country, money is a bit of an issue, which does affect like the facilities on offer for some things like the media, like TV equipment and radio equipment. But give them credit. They had a thorough investigation, completely trawled through the management system, had a complete overhaul, published the results of what they found. and the student satisfaction so that all the students could see. Because part of the problem was that Bristol had been going down in the national rankings partly because of student satisfaction, which is not very good to have. So I think they have acted on that, and having only been a year since they've started implementing it, it's a bit unfair to judge right now.
So what really was wrong? I mean, Bristol's supposed to be sort of one of the top universities in the country. What do you think was kind of wrong with it that was causing such low satisfaction?
Without wishing to be controversial, there was obviously a management issue, which I know nothing about, but it had to come from some kind of... But I don't know, their ingoings and outgoings must have been wrong somewhere. But I think there's also a lot of student apathy, and a lot of people don't almost know the union's there. I mean, they don't know what it offers, which... after what I've said about Freshers Week, might sound silly, but actually, yeah, you get that enthusiasm initially and people know where it is, but then they kind of forget about it.
Yeah.
They'll go there for an event, or they'll get so caught up in their halls. And it's true, but students do live in a bubble. They'll get so caught up in their halls that they won't take advantage, perhaps, of what they can get, and until maybe their publicity is better. Or they move the union, which would be nice.
Now you've over the excitement, obviously, of your initial sort of freshers thing 2 years ago. What do you think you're going to make of the new crop of freshers? Do you feel sort of old and cynical and you look down upon things and think, oh, here they go, another batch of newbies? Or
Yeah, you do. We all look at the... Well, you do. You see them as young people, really. You see them as young, but then you realise actually when you were that age... you thought you were pretty old, so we can't really think we're that much older. But you do, you see freshers and you realise how much of a difference the first year makes and how different you are after just a year at uni.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming in to chat to us. What sort of web presence, if people want to find out a little bit more about the sort of media that the British Student Union produce, where could they go?
Well, basically, there's the new one that I was on the committee starting up, mainly because I wanted to make an arts show, because I don't think there are enough arts shows and it's good to do, is Blink, which is my name, so I'm happy with it. It's a student television station, which anybody can go and watch. I mean, they changed the address recently, but if you go on the uni website, you can access Blink TV station, which has got pilots for lots of shows, and there's a sketch show out there as well, very, very funny, written by a very funny guy called Charlie, who's one of the writers. And there's a show called Fuse.
Okay, so if people Google sort of Bristol University and Blink, that'll come up.
Hopefully, yeah. And the one that was already out there, Burst, has been broadcasting for a long time.
Okay.
And it's quite good.
Casey Austin, thank you very much. And best of luck with your third year.
Thank you very much. Best of luck with you guys too.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Now I have some music, and this is Hawkwind with Silver Machine. We'll be right back. That was Silver Machine by Hawkwind. Have you ever wondered how many Concords would have been made if the American authorities had supported it? Probably not, but you're about to find out. Trevor Jenkins worked for Rolls-Royce at British Aerospace, and he says United States pressure led to only 20 being produced.
My name is Trevor Jenkins, and I got into the aircraft industry by going to a engineering school. The only qualifications I got at the technical school was advanced level drawing, O-level drawing, O-level maths, and additional maths.
So how did you come to be part of the Concorde design team?
Yeah, well, I did a five-year apprenticeship, and during that period of time and after that, I gained a ONC and an HNC. At Rolls-Royce.
And your HND and ONC was in?
Rolls-Royce Technical College and also Ashley Down College. I started as a detailed draftsman. I was working on Concorde, of course, the 593. Yeah, I did some work on Proteus. Well, I started working on the Concorde in about 1963, 64. Later, I was moved on to the design drafting. It was turbine blades and compressor blades, and I worked on all sorts of types of blades there.
So this is just to do with the actual engine, is it, rather than the actual airframe of the Concorde itself?
This is to do with the engines, but later I did work on the fuselage of the aircraft.
So how long did it take to actually design the Concorde, you know, from the first concept up to the first flight?
Yeah, I think the original treaty was signed in 1962, and it actually flew in March of 1969. When I started working on the fuselage, I was doing stress engineering rather than drafting.
So what does that mean? What does it entail?
Well, stress engineering is calculating the strengths of components to make sure that they were airworthy. Yeah, this was in the 70s when I was on and this was the sort of infancy of computing.
Right, so I'll say that again, shall I? In the 70s, computers were quite a new thing, weren't they? What were these old computers actually like, and were they much good?
Well, in the initial stages, we had to calculate, go right through the calculation that a computer would do to get the stresses.
But what were these old computers like? Were they reliable? Were they slow, fast, or what, compared to modern computers?
Oh, they were quite slow. They were very slow. And sometimes they overheated and they crashed and things like this.
Was it difficult getting the project in on time? Were there some hiccups?
There were hiccups, but this was mainly in the initial stages when we didn't have our computers to do the calculations, and there was always a sort of urgency to try and get it done in a quicker time than what we what was possible.
Were you biting your nails when it first took off, when the first flight, the maiden flight?
We were very worried that it wasn't going to fly, you know, but it showed that it was possible to actually produce a aircraft that would do supersonic speed.
Was there any point during the design and production of the first Concorde that you thought that it would never be made?
Yeah, because there was a lot of opposition from the Americans, actually, and it was mainly due to the noise of the aircraft. The thing was, I think, that they wanted to make it themselves. The Americans were trying to stop it from flying. They were saying that the footprint of the aircraft was too loud over land.
So this was actually, was they considering stopping building Concorde as a result of this?
Yes. British Aerospace were battling to try and keep Concorde, and there was the Americans trying to battle to get rid of it. Come to a compromise, I think, you know, that we managed to keep some of the aircraft.
And what are your thoughts about the way things have gone? Because obviously it was a couple of years ago now that the last Concorde flew here over here in Bristol and landed at Filton, and apparently no more are going to be allowed to fly because of safety concerns.
The aircraft actually had some debris on the runway when it crashed, but there were some other problems with the Concorde in the wings. I think there were some cracks in them.
I mean, do you think it was about time for the old lady to retire?
Oh no, I think it could have gone on actually, because you know, if you get cracks after so many years of flying, you know, it could have built other aircraft, or you could have tried to repair the existing aircraft.
Trevor Jenkins there, draftsman and engineer who worked through the 60s and 70s on the Concorde project, first for Rolls-Royce and then at British Aerospace. I'd like to think, perhaps, that we haven't seen the last of it, even though it's been decommissioned. It's so odd to think that we've now actually taken a back step. We're so used to technological progress, but yet in planes we seem to be going a little bit backwards. But there we go. And now we have some music, and this is Donovan with Hurdy-Gurdy Man.
Thrown like a star in my vast sleep, I opened my eyes to take a peek, to find that I was by the sea, gazing with tranquility. Just then, when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love, then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love. Histories of ages past, unenlightened shadows cast down through all eternity, the crying of humanity. 'Tis then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing songs of love, then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing songs of love.
Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy is what Vikings used to speak like. That's according to my memory of Count Dracula. They had some Viking characters in an episode, and they all went around wearing big helmets with horns on, and went, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, incessantly. So there you go, educational, you get to travel abroad via the radio. Now for this week's instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves. Story set in Oxfordshire in the 1920s, and eagle-eared listeners will obviously be familiar of this little blurb from previous weeks. If you remember, in 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting to experience, so he wrote about his experiences in a diary. The intro music is a tune called Old Molly Oxford and was performed by some musicians in the famous Royal Naval Volunteer Pub in Bristol.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. uniforms for every worker. Being the South Oxfordshire Hunt's steeplechases, we had 5 or 6 horses for the night, including the Prince of Wales's, who didn't come here himself. A party of Welsh Guards, Willie Makins, Dowding, Cyril Heber Percy, Higgin, Ackroyd, and 2 beautiful sisters Pritchard, lunched and dined. It's rather a boring job getting people to clean their boots after shows of this kind when coming into the house. In the hall, Cyril Heber Percy, Malapert lad, came up to me and asked, in a shrill voice, "Are you the head waiter, or do you merely provide the music?" A white jacket he knew, but buckled shoes were confusing. I was too tickled to reply appropriately. As for my buckles and white coat, every tradesman ought to wear a uniform. And not only for giving at least an impression of cleanliness, but to inspire confidence, i.e. godliness. One wants to feel that the man you are consulting is, pro tem, like God, wholly devoted to his job. How could a parson massing in mufti impress? Or a barrister? Or jockey? Or God? Or even a Hamlet? But there are many classes of tradesmen who fail us in this respect. The doctor could perfectly well wear a frock coat now that they are obsolete, just as the African medicine man wears a top hat, and a solicitor and hotel keeper, especially the upper class one. In these people, one doesn't want to see a perfect gent in +4s, but something superhuman. One comes to them as helps and comforters, not as competitors, or perhaps inferiors. I've always felt here that it's bad manners to appear in ordinary clothes, even to the plants in my garden, and when not wearing a white coat, I've hoped at least my buckled shoes, which I've worn for 30 years, would carry me through. At lunch there were 2 people, perhaps colonial, a nice-looking woman and her husband, fat and bald, save for some rust-coloured hair, rust freckles, and a rust-coloured suit. He asked for Evian water, which I said I hadn't got, but I added, "You ought to try our Tame water. It's supposed to be very good for rusting tanks." And seeing the quite accidental but apt application to the rusty fat gentleman, I turned to the woman and said with a smile, "Rather a rude thing to say, wasn't it?" However, they promised to stay here on the way back from Malvern. 2 old gentlemen and a wine cork. We had a good few to lunch, including a very courteous old gentleman, J. Roskill, K.C., with a party of 6. At the next table, 2 old boys of the London club variety had Mouton de Rothschild 14, and they said how splendid it was. When they had finished lunch, for something to say, I asked again, "And did you like the claret?" "Oh, it's all right," with a drawl. I was surprised by this complete change of attitude towards the now emptied bottle, when one of the old boys exclaimed, "It's not Chateau bottled." "Why, of course it is, and a very good bottle, because I tasted it." "Yes, you say Chateau bottled on your list, but look at the cork," which he handed me. On it was branded John Fothergill, Tame. So I explained the peculiar circumstances by which I occasionally opened a wrong bottle, and immediately afterwards re-corked it with a new cork. But they were unconvinced. "Have you a bottle with the original cork in it?" I brought one up. "Ah, that's the real thing," said one, and the other winked approval. "Good God, do you still doubt me? I'll open it and you shall taste it." So bang went my money on these old pretensions, but in vain. "That's something like Charles," he cried, "and this of a cellar cold wine when their own had been perfect." "That's more like it," said Charles. Then turning to me, "You should know that my brother is a great connoisseur of claret." The brother winked agreement. So I had to speak. "I deny that either of you knows anything about claret at all. In the first place, you, the connoisseur, gave me a shock when ordering the wine by asking me if Mouton de Rothschild, one of the 5 best clarets, was a red wine." At this, the connoisseur George turned to his brother and reproved him for giving him that reputation. "I never said I was a connoisseur, Charles." And they had a little recrimination for having landed themselves so well. "Secondly, besides not knowing claret, you don't know ordinary human nature. It never struck you that if I wanted to cheat you, I wouldn't have left the John Fothergill cork on the table in front of you." So I left them, looking forward myself to a good bottle in the evening. I saw one of them in a hall later. He made no advance, so I said, "I'm sorry about the claret business, but I really couldn't help it." "How old are you?" snapped the old boy. "After 30, age is nothing to do with the question." I hope the day may come when you'll be able to like your wine by the taste and not by the cork, though it's improbable now. And so they left. Forever. But there's a pathetic sequel for which I'm more sorry. Back to that club they'll go, but never again to talk together about wine, since each knows now that the other knows nothing about it. And if one of them is dining with clubmates like himself, he will have to look around before he joins in with the usual wine talk to see that his brother is not within earshot. It really wasn't my fault. Mr. Roskill, who had overheard the whole thing at the next table, told me afterwards that he wanted to give them a disinterested summing up, which I wish he had done. In the lavatory, having lost two good books, I put Bailey's translation of Lucretius, hoping that that would stay, but not even that. So now I've had for some months Theo Matthews, barrister, Forensic Fables, on which I've written Irremovable. A lady said to her husband, "We've got a good story for Theo when we get back." But Theo knows of its place already, for he wrote to E.S.P. Haynes that I was evidently a discriminating person. When E.W. Harding and I sat together in the summer afternoons at school writing lines, I little thought that 32 years hence I should be selling his handsome son a dinner. This evening he came himself. "How pathetic," I said, "that you are now a colonel and I a mere publican." "Yes, but I'm a bad colonel and you are a good publican." A lad called Duguid dines here often, a delicate, quiet, long-fingered lad of infinite politeness and modesty, with a great resemblance to Dick Innes and Monty Pollock's children and the royal family. His work is no good, but it's bound to be good one day, with all this at the back of it.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve for reading us another part of An Innkeeper's Diary by John Volio. Our intrepid reporter, Anthea Page, was at the Amnesty Garden party last Sunday, and it was held at Goldney House, which is now owned by the University of Bristol, was previously occupied by Thomas Goldney, hence the name, who's a wealthy Bristol merchant. Kath Mayle works with people in Gambia, showing them how to make rag rugs for sale in Britain, and you can hear about the craft of rag rugs in this feature, as well as a visit to the Shell Grotto in the grounds of the house.
Kath Mayall, speaking from Goldney House in Clifton at the annual fundraising event for Amnesty International, the Garden Party.
And you're selling rag rugs. Can you tell us a bit about the background to your stall?
They're rag rugs that have come from the Gambia in West Africa, where I spend several months during the winter time, and I teach people to make the rugs there and bring them back and sell them for the people who've made them.
Is this a village in the Gambia?
They're from different villages. It's not in just one village. Some of them are my neighbours and some of people I've known for several years.
And so you travel round, do you?
Yeah, I travel round.
Organising workshops?
Well, I don't organise workshops. I would go to a school if people invite me to a school and teach several people who've got craft skills already or interested. Or I would teach a women's group in a village.
What gave you the idea of making rag rugs? Have you ever made one before?
No, I remember them from my childhood. We probably always had one that my granny had made or mum had made, and I found a little rug tool in a box of odds and ends at an antique fair and thought it might be something I could do.
Do people make rag rugs here?
They do. There's a strong tradition in the northeast of people making rag rugs. Yeah, they sell for many, many more pounds than these sell for.
Because it's time-consuming.
It's very time-consuming. It's very intricate work, and yeah, they're really works of art. These are very basic, and by comparison, but they're a lot of work has gone into them.
How much are your doormats, for example?
The cheapest I've got are £15, and the most expensive I've got are £25. And some people say they're quite cheap, and some people think they're expensive, but the money goes a long way in the Gambia.
For young people here, though, who haven't got much money, they could make them for their flats and houses because they're very attractive.
They're very attractive. They're very easy to make. People say, "Oh, I couldn't do that," but in all honesty, it would take you 5 minutes to learn the basic technique.
Could you just run us through how you would go about making one then?
We have a little rug tool with a gripper on the end, like a pointed rug tool, and you poke it through the hessian.
Oh, where do you get the hessian from?
You can buy hessian new in the market, or we use recycled ones from pet shops that have had peanuts in, or I get in the Gambia, I use ones that have had imported potatoes in.
And the fabric is just old clothes, is it?
It's old clothes.
So any recycled?
Recycled old clothes from charity shops, or your old jeans or T-shirts or anything.
And then you use the tool to pull it with the hessian.
That's right. You can either make it in a continuous strip of fabric, making a looped style rug, or pieces of denim, for example, a couple of inches long, and make a shaggy, tufted style rug.
Where would you get the tool from?
Craft shops sell them. There's a craft shop in Clifton where you can buy them, and they retail, I think, about £89, something like that.
And if you want to do a fancy design, would you just mark the hessian?
You can mark the hessian with a felt tip pen to begin with, and just follow the outline of the design, or blocks of colour, or fancy designs.
So if anyone sort of thinks, yeah, that's really interesting, could they find books on it or Google it?
There are books on it. We've had several. I work in the Amnesty Bookshop in Gloucester Road, and they've had several very small books on, like the size of a child's book, very basic book, but just the basic technique for making the rag rug.
And on the internet as well?
On the internet, yeah. There's lots of rag ruggers on the internet.
Now, I know this sounds a silly question, but could you actually make a coat from, you know,
of course
this
you
technique?
Could. Yeah, of course you could, yeah. You'd look, it'd be pretty heavy. It'd be very heavy.
Unless you chose lightweight fabrics.
Yeah, yeah.
You said there was a man who supplied the tools in Cornwall.
Yes.
Has he got a website?
He's got a website. He's called John Corey, and his website is makings, with an S on the end, makings.co.uk, and he's donated 3 pages to me for my Gambia rugs.
And when are you going back to the Gambia?
In November.
Going into the grotto now at Goldeney House, and I'm going down some steps into a arched doorway with two Gothic windows on either side, and it's getting very damp as I go down, and on the right some rocks and ferns. There's a lot of people in here. There's a gentleman here, what's your name?
John Lewis.
He's just going to read a notice pinned on this old Gothic door about the grotto. It was begun in...
In 1737, it took 27 years, finished in 1764. It was the first major garden product of Thomas Goldeney, 1697 to 1768. But despite the 27 years in building, the actual shell was complete by 1739. Note the date, and initials 17, TG39, picked out in small shells under the roof light nearest the west door. The lion's den was finished in 1757. An American visitor in 1788 wrote, "We arrived at the door of the grotto situated under the terrace. The object that presented itself to our view was a lion in a sitting posture, and behind in a dark cave a lioness, the latter so lifelike that I could hardly persuade myself to the contrary. The miniature face to be found on the inside of the main door is said traditionally to be that of Anne Goldeney, 1707 to 1796, youngest sister of Thomas, who inherited the house in 1786. John Wesley, who visited Goldeney in 1788, called the grotto the largest and most beautiful he had ever seen, though he was not altogether sure the money was well spent. Water for the cascade was originally pumped up from the adjacent well by means of a fire engine, i.e. steam engine, fitted in the tower in 1764-66.
That's the little tower that's above it, isn't it?
Yes. The ornamental rock shells and fossils may have been gifts from interested friends or brought back in merchant ships from overseas, probably from America or the West Indies.
Or probably part of the Golden Triangle, the slave trade.
Yes, yes.
Now, could you just describe the grotto from the doorway for us?
Oh, that's tricky.
It's quite a big room, isn't it?
It is a big room.
Could you describe it?
Well, we've got
lovely columns.
Lovely columns, yes.
Glittery.
Yeah. It must be crystals set in the wall. There are conch shells and all sorts of shells, really. An arched roof, similar to what you see at a church, isn't it?
Yeah. It's quite big for a grotto, isn't it?
Yeah, biggest I've seen.
The floor's beautiful.
Yes, we've got a nice tiled floor.
Soft pink colours.
Yes.
And dark blue.
Dark blue in the centre there.
And opposite the door is this big stone lion.
Yes.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And that was Anthea Page interviewing Kath Mayle at the Amnesty Garden Party. Jeff Sparks is here with us for another edition of What's Going On. So over to you, Jeff.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 13th of August, Animals and Men will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol with support from Rita Lynch and Bimbo Spam. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £3 in advance and £4 on the door. On Friday, 14th of August, the Keith Little Band will be performing at the Old Duke in Bristol. The gig starts at 8:30 p.m. and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and I feature the White Stripes. This is the track Catch Hell Blues, and it's from the album Icky Thump, which was released in 2007.
We'll be right back.
That was the White Stripes with Catch Hell Blues from the album Icky Thump. For more information, you can check out www.whitestripes.com. Moving on to Saturday, 15th of August, and Kid Carpet will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance. Also on 15th of August, Poodles of Doom will be performing at King's Arms, which is at 1 Monmouth Street in Bath. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. On Sunday, 16th of August, the Corrie Tap All-Stars will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. The gig starts at 8:30 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on 16th of August, there is a fun day at Kingswood Park in Hollow Road, Bristol. There will be various activities, food, drink, games and entertainment, and all profits will go to the National Autistic Society. The event starts at 11 a.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. Now time for a poem from Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill. Trevor is a frequent contributor to Dialect Radio and is a member of the Lansdowne Poets.
I'm organising a Dead Poets Slam as part of the Bristol Poetry Festival. My name's Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and the event will be happening at the Lansdowne on Friday, the 28th of August. I'm looking for people to take part. If you choose your favourite deceased poet you would like to represent, entry is free and prizes will be given, or come along as part of the audience. It's £5 entry. So anybody who's interested either in taking part or in coming along for the show, the number to call is 07954 147 464. Thank you.
You're listening to Dialect Radio, one of the programmes produced for the Bristol Radio Co-op run by volunteers. You can email us on bristolradioco-op@live.com or visit our website on www.dialectradio.co.uk.
Cityscape. The rebels of the urban sprawl spray wild designs upon the wall. Is it art or vulgar scrawl adorning our fair city? Preferring to be out of sight, always ready to take flight, imposing images at night, ghost painters without pity. They're all anti-establishment, they don't approve of government. The nature of their art had meant big problems for the city. Through their street art they would invent the slogans of their discontent they sprayed on walls with ill intent that often wasn't pretty. From rotting squats they would emerge to give in to their graphic urge, and many people cursed the scourge imposed upon the city. They all disdain the 9-to-5, their urban art keeps them alive, though some think that their life's a skive and presence is a pity. Art history's a funny thing. What starts out as a rebel fling ends up in praises people sing all over the fair city. The blank walls wait for art to show. Now Banksy's style basks in the glow. He's Bristol art scene's Romeo, mysteriously witty. Yes, this new art has got respect. It's worth so much we must protect it in a space we all inspect. The galleries of the city. Now tourists come from far and wide. Street art is part of Bristol pride. We love this art we'd once deride. So God bless the Bristol city.
Now we have some music, and this is Led Zeppelin with Days to Confuse.
So long, it's not true. Wanted a woman, never bargained for you. Lots of people talking, few of them know. Soul of a woman was created for love. Yeah.
And that's the end of this week's Dialect Radio show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre. Our features were brought to us by Dialect Radio reporters Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Malcolm read another instalment of An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. And thank you very much to Katie Austin to agreeing to be interviewed, slightly at the last minute. And thank you to Trevor Carter for reading a poem. The What's On was presented by Jeff Sparks, and Mark Condon was the studio engineer. This week's show was produced by Jeff Sparks, and you can download the show on the internet at dialectradio.co.uk. Also, if anyone wants to join the team at Dialect, you can send us an email on bristolradiocoop@hotmail.co.uk. And that's all one word, Bristol Radio Co-op. It's goodbye from all of us here at Dialect Radio, and from me, John Peters Coleman. And take care of yourselves, and let's hope the sun stays out a little bit longer.